the average agents are at risk. Because if they're just a homogenized product where they're not adding any particular value, they will be challenged by technology and they will be replaced by the price shopper. But the slightly better than average to the top agents, I don't think they've got anything to fear, because I think that they operate a really unique place that can't be replaced by technology.
You're listening to Elevate, the official podcast of Elite Agent for Real Estate Industry, sales professionals, property managers and leaders. We bring you the best minds in business and real estate to help you list more, sell more and elevate your results. To download your written action guide from this podcast containing extra tips, links and shortcuts, visit EliteAgentElevate.com. Now, here is your host, Samantha McLean.
Welcome to another episode of the Elevate podcast, where we delve into some of the most interesting minds in business and in real estate for the very best tips and strategies for you to implement to elevate your business. I'm Samantha McLean, editor of Elite Agent and host of this week's show. Today, it's an absolute honour to welcome Bryce Holdaway, partner at Empower Wealth, buyer's agent and co-host of the Property Couch podcast and co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia. Originally from Perth for over 15 years, Bryce has been assisting home buyers and investors nationally and overseas to purchase property in every state and territory around Australia. So welcome to the show, Bryce Holdaway.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on. For someone so experienced in the property industry for almost two decades, you've got an amazing knowledge of Australia's property hotspots. We've all seen you on the telly and everywhere else and listened to the podcast. Can you tell us how your property journey began?
I was a degree qualified accountant from my hometown in Perth, and about the third year of a four-year degree, I started to realise that I think I did accounting because my dad was an accountant, not because I was really passionate about it. My house was about one suburb away from the university, so I used to go home for lunch, and the midday show with Ray Martin was on. And so, as you do, sit there and waste a bit of time. And Jan Summers came on and spoke to Ray Martin, had a whiteboard. And she started talking about how, you know, you could buy an investment property. She'd bought a number. And then if you buy enough of these things, you can create some real financial freedom. And the clincher was, she goes, and the tenant and the tax man will pay most, if not all, of your bills. And I'm like, did everyone just hear that? Like, why is everyone not doing it? And so now, as I get a bit older and a bit wiser, I realised that money is really simple, but behaviour is really hard. And so I understand now that people get in their own way and their headspace and their money beliefs and all that sort of thing. But that really sparked in me a mission to find out as much as I possibly could about investing in property, because I saw that as a pathway that I wanted to take. And therefore, I quickly realised that my career in accounting was probably short-lived. So I then pursued the property industry not too long after I got my first graduate role as an accountant.
Yeah, amazing. And I read somewhere that you purchased your first investment property around about 1999 in Perth, an apartment that cost around $200,000, but the median price at the time was a lot lower than that. So can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah. So the thing is, I had a mentor at the time who said all you needed to do is get seven properties in 7 years, and on the eighth year, you could actually harvest the equity in the first property and live on that. And then in the ninth year, you could harvest the equity in the second property, in the 10th on the third. And I just thought, wow, that's amazing. So I actually fell in love with a concept, and I paid very little attention to the bricks and mortar concept of what makes a good asset, right? So my only goal was to get my name on a title. I had zero science, I had zero thought around, well, should I actually be buying a right one? Which is the right one? Should it be a house? All I needed to do is get my name on a title, because then I felt like it arrived. And this was back, as you said, in 1999. So I was actually 23 turning 24. And so I bought with a mentor. We bought in a block of over 100. It was a real gem. I mean, if you had a look at the photo now, it's on a main road. There's 100 in the block. There's a pool, a caretaker, a lift. I was paying body corporate fees for a lift that my apartment didn't even get to benefit from. And you're quite right. If I reflect, I paid $199,940 for a three-bedroom apartment when the median price for a house in Perth was $158,000. Talk about missing the mark, but I consider that the greatest investment I've made, because my observation, I said it before, is money is simple, behaviour is hard. It's the fact that there's only just over 2 million property investors in this country. So to have actually got onto the property investing ladder set me up for a wonderful career and building a portfolio that's providing my family with a passive income.
Yeah, absolutely. So knowing what you know now, what would you do differently?
In Perth, I would have bought a house, because what's really interesting about the Australian market is people often say, how's the market going in Australia? Wow, really? Like, do you know how many submarkets there are in New South Wales, let alone Australia? There's hundreds and hundreds of submarkets. So I guess I probably would have better understood that apartments work really well in Sydney because of the density, but they don't work so well in Perth because the norm is a house. So I would have bought a house. And then if knowing what I know now, I bought in my own backyard, whereas I now preach to people that you should be a borderless investor, because if you grew up in Albury, Wodonga or the back of Bourke, it doesn't make sense to necessarily buy in your backyard because it might make sense to go somewhere else. So if you can be borderless, so if I had my time again, I had the same opportunity, I would buy a house in Sydney. It would have stretched me. It would have seemed like a lot of money at the time, but the price was in the 400s in Sydney, which is ridiculous. But at the time, it seemed like a lot of money. So I'd buy a house, I'd go to the East Coast, and I'd buy in a big population centre, and I'd let time do a lot of the work for me.
Speaking of different markets around Australia, we know that the regions are very different to the East Coast, very different to, you know, some of the other states like South Australia and Perth, where you're from. In location, 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 you get to travel around Australia looking at different markets. What are some of the most interesting areas you've seen lately?
I really enjoy the fact that we've got so much diversity in the type of real estate. So my latest show is called Escape from the City on the ABC, which is an adaptation of Escape to the Country, because no one in Australia necessarily escapes the country. Or if you think about the original location, 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 basically that was people who were moving out of London and trying to find a little bolt hole, have a bolt hole in London, then have a lifestyle choice outside. But if you look at the program, there's similar properties, barnhouse conversions or country estates. Whereas on Escape, I did a beautiful house had a beautiful brief in Port Douglas. So I got to see that sort of amazing tropical rainforest backdrop versus, I can still remember the first time that location, location, location took me to Tasmania, and I got to see these amazing rolling hills as we were filming an episode in Launceston, and you see some of the historical properties and just the beautiful landscape. So the diversity of what we have on offer. In Escape from the City, I just did one where we had a budget of just over $700,000 in Toowoomba. And when you think of that in comparison to Sydney standards, you think, oh, $700,000, that'd get me a garage. But in Toowoomba, that was well and truly above the median. So we were seeing some epic properties with 300-degree views that were just unbelievably good. So I am professionally blessed in that I get exposed to so much. You know, I've done Sydney's Lower North Shore, I've done the beaches, I've done the Inner East, I've done Brisbane, I've done Gulf. I've been lucky enough to be exposed and do transactions in every state. No, I actually haven't done a transaction in Northern Territory, but I've certainly been up there scoping it out. It's the only state or territory that I haven't.
Actually, I'm heading up to Darwin for the first time in my life next month, so anything could happen. But I'm really interested in this concept of borderless investors. You know, knowing that most of the audience here listening in today will be real estate professionals, how do real estate professionals work with this trend towards being a borderless investor?
Well, it depends if you're asking for them personally or professionally, because professionally it's very difficult for them, right? Because they obviously earn an income from a transaction, and being an expert in their patch is something that sets them apart from their competition in the same patch. So whereas, you know, I've got a team of buyer's agents who understand how to fulfill a brief. If a client's got $1 million to spend, we know that what that'll get us in Sydney, what that'll get us in Brisbane, what that'll get us in Adelaide, what that would buy us in Melbourne, what we'd do if we went down the road to Geelong. So it allows us that freedom to actually look across the border, because the way that a buyer's agent earns an income is tied to the human being rather than the bricks and mortar. So it is, I do get that it's difficult for a real estate agent, but personally, I'd certainly encourage them to do that. Professionally, I wonder if there's an opportunity for them to strike up some conjunction relationships where they can still make sure it's professional or commercially viable for them while still serving their client at the highest level.
I was going to say that, and with your experience as a buyer's agent, I know some real estate agents don't like working with buyer's agents, and then some real estate agents really do, and we've seen successful relationships unfold on shows like The Block and stuff like that. What would you say to a real estate agent in terms of working well with a buyer's agent? What are some tips there?
Look, I'd first of all say just don't judge the book by their cover, because I do understand that some buyer's agents are adversarial. They are actually peacocking to try and win business by trying to do it at the expense of the real estate agent. I understand that that's not ideal, but if you think about the majority of buyer's agents, they are professionals who want to facilitate a transaction on behalf of their client, and they want to do it. A perfect scenario, which is the opposite of television, by the way, but a perfect scenario is we get a brief, we clarify what they want, we go and assess what it looks like, we go and negotiate, and that client sends us a testimonial. That is the perfect scenario, right? Whereas television producers hate that. They want drama, they want twists and turns. So if a real estate agent realizes that is the goal of the buyer's agent, that's also the goal of the listing agent. They want to do a listing, showcase their expertise, they want to make sure the transaction's good, and they want to get a testimonial at the end so they can help get the next listing. So if they see it as a meeting of the minds of two professionals who are working together with a common outcome, and sure, they're both crossing the white line where they're thrashing it out on behalf of their vendor and we're thrashing it out on behalf of our buyer. But once we get a deal done, we shake hands and say, I'll see you on the next one. I think a real estate agent should embrace us as an industry. But I do get that we've got some rogues which are unpleasant to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. But that is good advice. And I was just, you just talked about the drama aspect of TV. And we've seen you on TV work with some very nervous and anxious people over the years. Do you have any advice for agents on the other side who might be dealing with nervous and anxious people? How do you calm them down and get the deal done?
Well, I understand that for a real estate agent who does this all day, every day, they have developed an immunity to how big this is. It's a high-value transaction. So it's probably the best agents don't forget that, right? But as you're building your experience, you can easily forget that it's a very big deal. So first of all, acknowledging that. And two, looking out for hidden agendas, right? Because quite often I want to make sure, particularly if I'm acting on behalf of the buyers on the show, I want to quickly work out if agendas aligned. Because where's a hidden agenda here? Where's a hidden criteria that I don't know about, which could be causing some anxiety? Because I want to know where the conflicts exist. You want to actually live in a city on a smaller block, but the other person in the transaction prefers a bit of size and is happy to commute, right? So that's a point of friction, which is causing anxiety within their own relationship, let alone the interaction that I'm having with the client. So I'm trying to get authenticity and to ground zero as quickly as I can so that I can address that. I can make the invisible visible, show them what the process is, so that then if there's little to sort of less that's unknown, there's less to fear. So for a property investor, for example, I know there are two main periods of anxiety, so I front foot those. The first main period is I always say I'm never in a hurry to find a property, but when I find a good property, I'm in a hurry. So I front foot that to say that we'll take as long as it takes to find it. But just know that we buy established properties, not brand new, we buy established properties, and it moves quickly. So let's be prepared for that. So I reverse engineer what that looks like. So I do a set to buy meeting when I engage the client to say, this is what you're going to expect in that first anxious period. So is there any questions or queries that you have? Then number two, I send out, once I've engaged the brief, I'll send out a heap of properties where there's a bit of disparity, it's a bit of a cross-section. I'll send it out to them to say, okay, what do you think of these properties? Typically, they've just recently been purchased, because what I want to flush out from them is the hidden knots, right? Because you know when you go through the engagement process, if you think about listing agents, they're in their lounge room. Everyone's sort of in an anxious nod. Yep, everything's nod. But it's not until we get to the real pointy end of the business where all of a sudden they go, oh, I'd never accept that, or I'd never go to auction, or I'd never buy a townhouse. And I'm like, oh, gosh, I wish we'd had this conversation earlier. So I do that to flush out some of those hidden questions that might not come until the pointy part. And then the other bit of anxiety is for an investor is that when it settles and they go, will I ever get a tenant? And so I front foot what that looks like, how we're going to proactively get a property manager, what sort of property manager you should look for, all those sorts of things, so that then I can really show them what the process looks like, show them on a timeline, show them where the anxiety is, and I can then minimise any unknowns that can come from a highly stressful time, whether they're on the selling side or whether they're on the buying side. It's the same.
Yeah, interesting. So it's a bit like the tip of the iceberg, really. So what the anxiety that you see outwardly is what's going on the top, but you take the time to find out what's underneath before you actually hit the road.
Absolutely, because it's going to – for me, it's a little bit easier, I've got to say, because sometimes for a listing agent, sometimes they're competing against two other – agents, and they, you know, I understand that it's difficult to compete. You've got to give them an impression of what the house is worth, and then when it's maybe the market's giving them information suggests that it's got to come. I understand that that's difficult, but for me, I've got the good fortune of having the relationship specifically with the client and no relationship with any form of real estate until we find the one. So for me, I want to dig, I want to understand, because it's anxious for me if I'm trying to juggle a relationship with a real estate agent who is giving me an opportunity and then all of a sudden I have to ring up and say, oh, you know what, my client's got cold feet. That actually isn't ideal either. So it's about managing those expectations and realising that the quicker I can get to what's really going on, the smoother the transaction's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to pick up on something else that you just said in your previous answer about the anxiety being around investors trying to find a good tenant. So there's probably a lot of property managers listening into this podcast right about now. Do you think that finding a tenant is the top anxiety once the property's been purchased for an investor?
Yes, I do, because that's the point where essentially they're on their own. Now, within our business, we have a 90-day review and then a 12-month review. So we kind of say to them, the assignment's not closed until we've had that 90-day chat. But for most people, they think, like most of their fears often that they won't say is, oh, have I paid too much? Will I ever get a tenant? Have I made the wrong decision? I can't talk to my friends because they're going to tall poppy me, all those sorts of things. So that's the point where they feel, oh, gee whiz, if I don't get a tenant, I'm in trouble here. So part of that for me is to reassure them that they've bought in an area that is in demand, but also just reassuring them that if you connect up to I like to call them an asset manager, not a property manager, right, even though they are a property manager, because if the property manager is taking a bigger picture view, these people are doing it as a form of self-funding their retirement, and we want the property manager to make suggestions around, well, I actually think if you put a wall in here, you might be able to create another living room. Or what I've seen down the road is they gave it a lick of paint and they did a very cheap makeover and all of a sudden it made $20, $30 difference. All those sorts of value add exercises are really what I think investors want to hear, because ultimately a property manager's got a tough job, and the way that they can maintain that relationship with the vendor is to look for opportunities to have dialogue where they're adding value rather than just collecting rent and collecting their management fees.
That's a growing, what you're referring to there is what we're seeing as a bit of a helicopter trend in the industry, with downward pressure on management fees in property management. You know, there's a lot of outsourcing going on of some of the admin tasks, and investors we're seeing are really looking for their property managers to start being a bit more proactive in terms of how do I add value to this asset. Is there any advice that you can give property managers in dealing with the modern type investor who might be looking for, you know, something different?
Yeah, just understand the dialogues that they expect you to sort of be using, because for them it's a return on investment. How can they add value? And I always say to an investor, there's four things that we're really pressure testing a property on when we're assessing whether it's a good one or a bad one. First one is, the reason I like established properties is because there's historical precedent, right? So I don't ever want to be the first person to buy the real estate, because there's no testing on the price. But I'm the second and subsequent purchaser, I can actually back test and see how that asset's actually performed. It's pretty easy to do. So number one, I want to check its capital growth potential. Number two, I want to have a yield. So I might need 3% yield, or I might need 2.5%. Or if I go to Queensland, I might be able to get 4 or 4.5. So they're your two major ones. But the third and the fourth one is, I want to understand the vacancy rate, because if I can't get a tenant, that's going to just feed into the anxiety. And the fourth one is, I want to know what the quality of the tenant is, because it's one thing to actually get a tenant in, but if I can't get them out or they're damaging my asset, then I'm in a whole world of pain, because for most property investors, they're not flush with cash. They're balancing cash flow themselves to try and get to a point where it moves into equilibrium. So those four things are part of the vernacular for property managers, should really be thinking about that. Hey, the quality of the tenant, the vacancy rate in this area, this is what I think I can do to add value to increase the yield, and just give them some comfort around the type of asset that they're buying. I always say a property manager can distinguish themselves from the pack by being part of the discussion when you're buying. So when I'm buying an asset, I reckon you should be talking to the property managers before you actually contract, because the property manager is the person who has to inherit the asset after settlement to try and let it. And if you're next to a methamphetamine lab or a known undesirable area, or it's a massive cut through that has traffic at school, like, they're going to know that and they're going to tell you, right? So whereas the sales agent, through human nature, is just going to tell you the positives.
In your business, do you recommend property managers to your investors, and is there a certain thing that you're looking to work with in a property manager?
Yeah, we do. So we interview the property managers. We ask them the questions, but we get past the glossy brochure, right? Because everyone's got a glossy brochure and they've got their stock standard things that they will do. The structure of the business is really important, because quite often you have a business development manager who engages with the landlord, gets them on board, and then they hand it over to a crew.
Yeah.
We'll make sure that crew has the ability to not necessarily lose the standard of service that we're expecting, that we usually get from the BDM. One of the tests we do is we just say, ring them up and leave a message, see how quickly they return your call. That's going to be a good sign. We often favour, not exclusively, not as a general rule, and there are plenty of exceptions, but we often favour property managers who are just property managers.
Oh, right, okay, yep.
Because that's core business, right, rather than being, trying to be sensitive, but some property management departments can just be a for cursory part of a sales agent business, and the sales agent's where all the energy and attention goes and the property management department just keeps the lights on. We're trying to find the asset managers who are really being proactive and build a long-term relationship with clients, with our investors.
What do you think the future looks like in terms of real estate offices? So you just talked about the need to have a property manager present when the sale's happening, which I think is interesting. I mean, some people do that now and other people still are not so much in favour of that approach. But what do you see the future looking like in the real estate industry with everyone talking disruption and all of that sort of thing?
There's a lot going on in that question. So if I was a property manager, what I would do is I'd proactively market myself as someone that you can talk to prior to making a decision. So I'd be putting out free reports, I'd be putting out videos, I'd be putting out content into the marketplace that shows that you are a leader and someone who can be seen as an authority, because I've got the view that people trust the messenger only after they trust the message, right? So if you can get in front of that message and say, these are the things you should look for when you're buying as an investor, here's in my experience what I've seen that a lot of investors don't realise until after they've settled, just sharing some of that wisdom, all of a sudden would be a reciprocity exercise where the investor would go, wow, this person's actually trying to find out, add value to me. I want to talk to them. So they'll proactively become an attraction agent through doing that. So I would just look a little bit outside the square. In terms of real estate industry, I don't think I'm qualified enough because I'm not a listing agent in the day. But what I do know is that, sure, we can cut fees, but I don't think that's the answer, because some of the very best agents that you've had on your podcast can negotiate so much better than a cut price fee person. It's ridiculous. The net position is so far in favour of the experienced agents, not funny. So what I do think is the risk for the real estate agency, from my outside observation, is the average agents are at risk, because if they're just a homogenised product where they're not adding any particular value, they will be challenged by technology and they will be replaced by the price shopper. But the slightly better than average to the top agents, I don't think they've got anything to fear, because I think that they operate a really unique place that can't be replaced by technology.
So it's really about upskilling and educating yourself on property investment as a science, so that you know what value you can add to investors out there in the marketplace right now.
Yeah, that's right. So a real estate agent, for example, can differentiate themselves by understanding some of the vernacular that you need for a property investor, because a real estate agent needs to know how to list. They need to know how to put a campaign in place. They need to know how to issue the photographer. They need to know how to keep the client updated. They need to know how to give them a report. All these things, right? But they don't necessarily translate into, if you were to just then have a conversation with an investor doesn't really care what your campaign looks like. They don't care that you can turn it around. Like, so that type of dialogue is saved for the people in the lounge room that you're trying to get a listing from. It's the buyer needs a different vernacular, and you need to have that as part of your armory.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of upskilling and educating yourself, you've got a great podcast too called The Property Couch. Firstly, how did that start?
Yeah, it was one of those ones where Ben, my co-host, and I, we have a business here called Empower Wealth. He was the chair of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia, so he was the first port of call when people were making complaints. And then we have a client base here where we were seeing people buy properties that were just setting them back at best a decade, but in some cases more, because of poor asset selection, being spruced to buying the wrong asset and all those sorts of things. So we were privileged and fortunate enough that because the business was providing us with an income, and we've both been in the industry for 20 plus years, we had this luxury of being able to provide a podcast that allowed us to share our voice. Now, back then, that's 5 years ago, back then there wasn't a lot of podcasts around. There's plenty now. It was new. We didn't really know what it meant. We celebrated our first 10,000 downloads like we'd won, you know, the AFL Grand Final, the NRL Grand Final for your Sydney folks. But we've now ticked over close to 6.5 million downloads. So it's been a real surprise to us, but it's been a real pleasure to see that, you know, someone will put on, put it this way, people will self-identify in three ways. They'll either be the do-it-yourself crowd, they'll be the do-it-with-you crowd, or they'll be the do-it-for-you crowd. And I feel like the podcast can serve all three of those, where the do-it-yourselfers can actually apply the principles, go out and do it. And they often tag us on socials, which is a really meaningful and fulfilling process for us. But then there's time pool. People will say, hey, listen, I just need it done for me. You guys are the authority because they trust the message, therefore they can trust the messenger, and therefore they'll get us to do it for them. So I feel like it's a bit of an opportunity for us to give back for something that served me and Ben particularly well over the last 20 years and our families.
I feel like there's a little mini lesson there in fees too, actually. Like, you know, if you're a real estate agent listening to this, there's a done with you service and then there's a completely done for you service, which I think plays into the trend that we're seeing at the moment of consumers with choice. Like, my choice is I want to pay you a low fee and I'm going to go and do this much of it myself, or I'm going to pay you a premium and you're going to do everything for me.
Absolutely. And then just working out who fits into what category. But I'm observing a lot of real estate. I go to ARIC every year. I look at some of the best players from afar. And the ones that are doing really well, Samantha, are the ones who I feel are doing the message before the messenger. So what they're doing is they're providing real value that people can get some takeaways and therefore as a result be seen as an authority. But I'm also seeing too many people do it wrong, where they're actually just going, hi there, look at this property, look at me, I can help you. And it's like, whoa, it's too early. It's way too early. You've got to provide value, ask for nothing. You've got to provide value, ask for nothing. You've got to provide value, ask for nothing. And then after that third one, you go, hey, listen, if some of this stuff resonates with you, why don't you and I just get together and have a chat and see what the next step might look like? The ones who are really doing well, particularly with video, are those people. What's a genuine takeaway? And it doesn't have to be complex, because you might just do a quick video that explains how do you exchange a contract in New South Wales. Because I grew up in WA, we don't exchange contracts. We just do offer and acceptance. In Victoria here, it's offer and acceptance. Where in New South Wales, that's unique to your state, right? So why don't you just explain what exchange means? Explain to someone, what does gazumping mean? I mean, most real estate agents could riff that on their iPhone without too much effort and then upload it to YouTube. And therefore, all of a sudden, just build up these layers. What happens when a finance clause is required? What should you look out for when there's a building inspection? There's just so many tiny little nuggets. And I think most people get carried away with the fact that I've got to make it this world-class event with some of the best videography that exists. I can assure you that some of the most response to YouTube, Facebook Lives that we've done have just been scratching around rather than some of the better produced stuff that we put out there that think, oh, wow, I thought that might fly a bit better.
Yeah. Or I think the other mistake is thinking that everyone knows it just because they know it so well. You know, I know sometimes, you know, like I'll see an article for the magazine or something like that and I think, oh, everyone's heard that before. But then I've got to remember too that some people are just entering the industry like today. So,
absolutely. Really good tip. Yeah.
Totally never too late. That was what I was going to ask. Speaking of education, so are there any favourite episodes of The Property Couch that you can remember that would be great, because we like to leave links and things like that in the show notes? Are there any that particularly come to mind that people should listen to or check out?
Time poor people, if they were to listen to the first 20 episodes of our podcast, they are all the foundations. And in fact, what I've done is at the end of every podcast, I now give people the opportunity to download a PDF where you can get those top 20 episodes with all the framework. So, you know, we can make sure there's a link to that in the show notes. And I also, if anyone's interested, you can get a free copy of my book, The Armchair Guide to Property Investing. If you want a free guide, just go to thearmchairguide.com.au. I've bought the book. All I need you to do is pay for the postage to get it into your hands and I'll send it out to you. So that is something you can do. And also, We wrote a book called Make Money Simple Again, which was the second book we wrote, but it was the prequel. And largely because, you know, I mentioned before, money is simple, behavior is hard. So we've got a money management system that you can manage your money in 10 minutes a month. So you don't have to micromanage anything, everything you do, so that you can trap more surplus, and then you can actually either choose to invest it in the lifestyle, or it's our hope that you invest it in your future. So if you go to makemoneysimpleagain.com.au, you can get a free PDF download of that. There's a few resources there for people to equip themselves and hopefully skill themselves up in the investment space so that they can give their clients more value.
I'm downloading that now. It sounds really good. I'd normally sort of end with asking a couple of questions like, what's the best advice you've ever received? But you've said a couple of times during our chat now that money is easy, but behavior is hard. Is that the best piece of advice you've ever had?
Yes. First of all, is to buy real estate, right? You know, it's a very, very stable, wonderful asset, right? And it's almost backed at the ballot, because the Australian government will never let your house plummet because it's too contingent on votes. But what I've observed is over 20 years of doing this, I've seen people put a plan in place. I've seen them then engage a buyer's agent. And then I've seen them buy really great assets that do really great things for their portfolio. And then they, for whatever reason, they self-sabotage, and I catch up with them 3 or 4 years later, and this happened, that happened, had to sell it. I'm thinking, what on earth? All you needed to do was follow the bouncing ball, just follow the plan. So then as you get a bit wiser, you realize that people have all these money beliefs. It could be as simple as you grew up and your parents said, don't put that 20-cent piece in your mouth because money's dirty. Or you might have something that says, easy come, easy go, or money doesn't grow on trees, or money equals work. So people will start to have these ingrained beliefs that undermine what it is to go for. You know, your subconscious is designed to keep you safe. And so if you were told that money's dirty, you'll actually lose all your money just so that you can't be called dirty. But you don't have that at the front of the mind, you have that at the back of your mind, right? So what I think is, and I'm more and more passionate over time, is to help people uncover these money beliefs that derail them. Because without those beliefs set in stone, that people will have money flowing in and out of them. So there's an episode where we talked about that. It's essentially, if you can imagine a tree, I'll try and do this for an audio audience, because if you can imagine a tree that has all these roots underneath, and then it's in the soil, and then the trunk is there, and then you've got the branch and the leaves. Most people, the branch and the leaves is the equivalent of knowledge in action, right? So what knowledge do I need? What action do I need to take? But the problem is that the roots that are in the ground are what need to be watered. So no one goes and waters the leaves and the branches. They go and water the roots. But in our own lives, we go and water the leaves and the branches, because we go, what's the next step? What are we going to believe? So the money beliefs are the roots. The soil is your external influences. So the sum of the people that you spend your time with. So I spend my time with really A graders. I'm going to become an A grader by association. So that's the soil. And then the trunk is really your internal attitude. What are your value system? What drives you? All those sorts of things. So if you believe that the fruit from the tree is largely around the strength of the roots of the tree, so too in our own life. The strength of our own financial position is largely determined by the quality of the money beliefs that we have. And if you have rubbish money beliefs, you will continually have money come in and out, and you will be hitting your head up against the wall, and you'll be thinking, gee whiz, I just can't get it to stick. It's because your subconscious is protecting you, and if you don't uncover what that looks like, that will continue to happen forever.
Yeah, really interesting. Actually, you just brought back a memory. My grandmother actually said that exact same thing to me. Don't put that in your mouth, it's dirty.
Yep.
It was only just then that I remembered that. So I'm sure that there's a lot of people probably nodding their heads along with us right now.
My family is a battler family. Well, I grew up in a middle-class family in Perth, but probably sort of lower to middle end of middle class. And my dad worked 2 jobs and he worked long weekends and money was tough. And I grew up in the recession we had to have. And so to me, we're battlers, right? Mm. So if I succeed, therefore I disassociate myself with my family, and that doesn't feel safe. Well, until I bring that up to the surface, I don't have any awareness around that. I'll keep derailing. Whereas now I know, I work on those beliefs, anything that comes up. So basically anyone who has some form of resistance, that it doesn't feel easy, they have some form of belief that they need to overcome, they need to work on it. Because once they clear it, they'll get different results. And clearing it's really simple. You've got to, first of all, identify it. Secondly, you've got to weaken it. And third, you've got to replace it. So it's the weakening comes from the awareness.
That's fantastic advice. Thank you very much for that. And thank you also for joining us on the podcast. It's been absolutely amazing to meet you and have a chat to you and all the rest of it after, you know, sort of seeing you on social media and all that sort of stuff for so long. If there was one thing that you would like to leave listeners with as a result of listening to this podcast, what would it be?
It would be that we've talked about it, but money really isn't that difficult. If you read our book, Samantha, you will realise that it is at primary grade level understanding. There is just no rocket science in it whatsoever. And it's actually just one debit card, one credit card, one offset account and your passive loans. That is it. And you think, this is too simple, right? So it has to be the behaviour that we've got to spend more time on. So I know a lot of your listeners are high achievers. I know they like to challenge themselves for personal growth. They want to better themselves. I would encourage them to work out if they've got any derailers around money beliefs and knock them on the head, because they might even 2x, 3x, 10x their current GCI that they're earning in their own business just because they're getting out of their own way.
Yeah, absolutely. Or getting into property investment, which they're in a great position to do.
Well, that's a no-brainer. The challenge for real estate agents is they go, well, I had a good year this year, but surely I can't back it up next year. So there's always that anxiety around the lack of continuity of income. And they go, well, how do I service these loans and all those sorts of things? I would say to the real estate agents to back yourself in, because even you can even plan conservatively on halving your income so that you don't have to sort of get white knuckles and lose sleep at night because you've got enough going on. So you're in the front row of the best investment class, in my opinion. So take advantage of it.
Absolutely. Bryce Holdaway, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Elevate from Elite Agent. To download your written action guide from this podcast containing extra tips, links and shortcuts, visit eliteagentelevate.com.